This is the question-answer period for a speech called Moving the Earth, Car Culture, by Professor Matthew Patterson of the University of Ottawa and presented by the Vancouver Institute on April 14, 2007.
Questions, ladies and gentlemen.
The question, if you didn't hear it, there was who killed the electric car? I'm not by instinct a conspiracy theorist. On the other hand, there's plenty of evidence that firms periodically have interest in quashing the competition. And historically, at least, I mean, the details that are in the well-known film aside, historically, at least, car firms and oil firms, the big car firms and the big oil firms have seen themselves for 60 years of having basically identical interests. So the car firm, the GM and Ford and so on, instinctively are wedded to the oil combustion engine model. Partly technological conservatism, you know, it's what they know. So they know how to build that sort of car. And partly because they see themselves as part of the same block and that GM's interests are the same as Exxon's. But I mean, there's an older history, actually, of the early 20th century when, you know, if you look in, right as late as 1910, there were as many electric cars on the road as there were oil cars on the road. And there, the only history I know of that actually says that the main thing is because, which is history of America, is since the principal, she says that the principal, if you like, symbolic ground under which electric cars were attacked was actually about gender. It was that electric cars aren't manly enough. You know, this is a period when people were in internal combustion engine cars where, you know, you had to crank it by hand, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, well, electric car, you just press a button. I mean, where's the romance in that? Where's the power in that? So, that, I mean, more than I can do in a quick response, says that was once the principle, you know, it was a cultural politics as much as the political economy, if you like. So I'd say that there are powerful economic conservative forces which sometimes inhibit radical technological change like that, but we don't necessarily need to think of it as a conspiracy as such. Shall I repeat that? The question was broadly, if I'm going to sort of correct me if I get you wrong, there's also at the same time in the last 5-10 years been a trend towards retro cars. You know, reinterpreting cars of the 30s like the PT Cruiser, or thinking about going back to the muscle cars, and the revival of the Mustang might be part of that, I don't know. But anyway, I could have done it, actually include it with the adverts. In advertising, there's also a big trend towards nostalgia. Actually, that started in the 1980s, a couple of things I've read, but also things I think myself, is I think the nostalgia that fits within the same thing. There's a nostalgia for a past, and one of the nostalgia amongst car buffs and car firms, if you think of Chrysler, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have all the problems we have now? We don't have to deal with all this environmental regulation. We don't have to deal with all these people slagging us off for being so hot, useless on X, Y, and Z. Wouldn't it be nice if we can go back to the golden age? So I suspect there's a bit of that, that the nostalgia is like recognising that we are no longer in that situation of the golden age where everything was hunky-dory and so on. But we want to sort of present it as if we still are there. That's how I'd read it, but I don't know if that makes sense.
Is the appetite going to continue?
I think that nostalgia is a reasonably... I think there's a lot of people who are enormously attached to their cars, but know, in a way that nobody would have done in the 1960s, that attachment to their cars is part of the problem. And so nostalgia is one way of dealing with that sort of cognitive dissonance, that sort of, how do I deal with this? Well, that ambivalence is maybe the best. Are there any geographical differences, in particular in BC, given there isn't an automotive industry, or an oil and gas industry? Are people less attached to cars here? It changes the dynamic when it becomes a political question, in the sense that if you talk in Oshawa of being anti-car, then you get people sitting there saying, "You trying to put me out of work?" And that dynamic doesn't exist. But beyond that, I'm not so... And that changes the political dynamic in some contexts a little bit. But I wouldn't necessarily say that people are, if you like, culturally less attached to their cars here than they would be elsewhere. You certainly, on a broader international scale, yeah, huge differences in terms of... But the difference there, and if you did compare North America to Europe very crudely, then the differences are, if you like, the different histories of urban structure. I mean, if you're living... I mean, you live in many European cities. For the journeys that we have to do in cars in North American cities, it just doesn't make any sense to use your car there. So there's a different attitude that arises out of what makes sense in daily life. That's why, a strategy like smart growth and densification and so on is, and mixed-use zoning and all that sort of changes in planning culture is central, because they reorganize, they, if you like, re-engineer what just makes sense on a daily basis. But that's the central cultural or origin of those sorts of differences, I would say. I'm not sure. I mean, again, if I look at Ottawa, where I live, compared to Toronto, and one has a car industry, one doesn't, I'm not sure I'd see that much substantial difference. One interesting sort of BC-related point is, of course, the fuel cell industry, the world pioneer for the fuel industry, at least was, based in Vancouver. I don't think you could say it is now. I suspect it still has plant here, but... Ballard Technologies was a sort of could have become the Canadian pioneer in new post internal combustion engine technology, but didn't stop getting Department of Defense grants and so on, and the vision to sort of make that the make Canadian industry the heart of a sort of progressive future sort of died away. The opportunity was lost.
Do you see a growing awareness of people that their health is being impacted by this car culture and that be recognized?
The question was, do I see a growing recognition of health problems associated with cars and demands coming from that? I mean, it's certainly one of the sources of movements against cars or against the ill effects of cars comes from that health-oriented thing. I would say there's three sorts of versions of that. One, the oldest of which is air pollution related stuff from the late 40s in Southern California and then progressively elsewhere. So people worried about lead in children's brains, asthma. That's one sort of category, but it's got a long history, and it's the second of which is to do with safety and danger in cars. The Ralph Naderite sort of activism from the mid 60s onwards. And the third, which is much more recent, which is about what some people call obesogenic environments. The car-dependent environments are structurally, if you like, they build in too little exercise into just daily life. So people have to go and take out gym subscriptions. You get this sort of slightly bizarre phenomenon of people driving to the gym, which sort of doesn't quite make, So there's that, and this is that sort of moral panic, if you like, about... about the lack of exercise in a car-dependent society. But they're not... I mean, they're quite old. They're going back to the 40s. If you look at air pollution, there are some dramatic success stories in urban air pollution. So the dioxide emissions are dramatically down. Nitrogen oxide emissions. Oh, I'm going to get this wrong. Anyway, it doesn't matter. There are some dramatic success stories, but most emissions are, if you like, where there have been regulation... The growth of the whole of cars as a whole has outstripped the decline in emissions per unit of travel. So it's not; those are unresolved problems. I don't see them. I guess I don't see health becoming more and more an important component in why people and in motivating people to oppose cars. I think it's more of a constant and changing in form over time.
I'm interested in the Asian approach. And the Asian solutions that were advocated in the planning of the new city of Dalian for 5 million people, where they had dedicated areas for urban transport by electric cars, cycle lanes, and limited motor car transportation. Is there anything planning for the future in Europe that addresses this type of policy?
Summarise the question: is there anything in the example of some of the planning of contemporary Asian cities? That's a specifically Chinese city, is it?
Yeah,
I think so. Dalian. And is there any equivalence in Europe that can be drawn on in the North American context, are you thinking, or just generally? Yeah. The difference of that, at least if it's the same example as the one I have in my mind, then that's an example of an entirely new city that's been built from scratch. And they're planning it I forget exactly when it was going to be up, in 5 years or whatever, and it's going to be a city of 3-4 million people. A large city, anyway, that's designed, it's the first ecologically planned designed city, at least that's how it's being sold. You don't build cities from scratch in Europe in the same way. It's a more of a series of piecemeal ones. There are some quite good examples of, in the Netherlands and in some German cities, where they're building specific neighbourhoods where people who buy houses or rent a house or a flat, an apartment, whatever, in those areas, commit themselves. The rider is, if you go and live there, you don't own a car. And they build that in with a couple of car shares that are on the edge of the community that you can use for when you need a car, etc., etc. But the engine, getting, if you like, social buy-in to the planning of cities around pedestrian cycling and public transport. There are plenty of, so it's a series of small examples, I guess. I mean, you could think of the example of London, which has introduced, you now pay £5 a day to drive into central London as means of engineering changing behaviour, but also financing public transport and so on through the money made from the congestion charge scheme. But there's no big heroic solution in the way of that sort of the example you gave that I can think of.
That's right.
Hi, I have a question. Is it of a romantic idea, but it happens anywhere in the world, especially here. If you look at the actual space between here and Lynchburg, it's like a beautiful area. And everything. And the space has an intrinsic value of using that. So once you put a motorway up there, or a big freeway that you can kind of whisper, if you want to get to whisper, then suddenly the space is awesome. And therefore, it no longer has value. And you see anything along the ideas of politics or car culture, where the actual evaluation of open spaces is something that is involved with car culture.
If I can summarise the question, has the expansion of car culture, and in particular, building of large roads which enable us to get to particular places, Whistler was your example, and the visual impact in terms of the way that the space physically looks and we experience it, is that everywhere in between is an obstacle? When people talk, it's more, if you like, cultural historians talk about the changes that cars, there's a wonderful book called The Culture of Nature, and one of the, by a guy from Toronto, who died a couple of years ago, and one of his large chapters is called The View from the Road, and the way that being at a wheel is a fundamentally different way of experiencing the space around you than if you're, say, walking through it or just sitting there contemplating it. And so that as we've... others, though, say that the car is not, in some senses, the distinctive change in terms of how we experience space. Actually, the train did that for us. Because the train was the same thing, where you experience the world around you that you've never seen before. You just experience it through the window as I think something going past you fast. But on the other hand, you also experience all those places in between as just in the way. So you might still appreciate them in some sense, but it's a more superficial appreciation at the very least. It's a common complaint about. It certainly has been an instigator of movements against road building. For the destruction of the particular space itself, you know, that road is going to destroy this environment, etc., etc. So it's a source of... And there's a book by an American historian called Driven Wild, that's the name of the book, not the the author, which is all about the development of the wilderness protection movement in the US as being fundamentally about, you know, what defines a wilderness in US legislation, partly because of this lobbying, is a space with no roads. I mean, that's virtually the first definition of a wilderness in US law, because of that sort of lobbying, precisely because they knew that as soon as you put a road in there, people will experience it completely different. So I think that, I mean, you're right to say that it's an instigator of certain opposition. But of course, the problem is that you also get people saying, oh, that's such a beautiful flyover. Fantastic road, that. I mean, I've got a friend colleague in Lancaster in the UK where you've got a particularly famous bit of the M6, which most environmentalists would just detest. And he's an environmentalist, a political philosopher. And he just adores it. He just thinks it's one of the most beautiful pieces of architecture he knows. So people react to the road as itself sometimes in as an aesthetically, you know, their aesthetic reaction to the road can be sort of, it gets a bit in the way of that because it can go both ways. Some people think that it's just a blot on the landscape. Other people think it can also be a beautiful thing in itself. So.
Sure. I was wondering where you see automotive technology going, especially in light of climate change, as you mentioned, but also oil change. And particularly if you talk a little bit more about hydrogen, you mentioned hydrogen already. We have balance in town that are very well known. But a lot of analysts think that hydrogen is a bit of a red herring.
My sense from the conversations and reading about what industry and insiders tend to think is that they think fuel cell is here. It's a done deal. And that, I mean, certainly if you talk to them, even in 2000, that, you know, some of them would have been saying yes, some of them would be saying no, some of them would be saying, even the ones who were saying, yeah, the fuel cell is the technology that will replace the internal combustion engine, they would be saying, well, maybe it'll start to become commercial in 2030. And there are, it's not quite clear, but there are three or four of the firms that are now thinking they'll have a first commercial fuel cell car on the road in 2012. But rapid acceleration in terms of bringing that technology to market. From an environmental point of view, the central question is where does the hydrogen come from? I mean, there's an infrastructural question, which is the obstacle. I mean, how do you get the hydrogen in the car? But there is one level of sort of, there's already a large infrastructure for compressed liquids, which is how the hydrogen would be produced, which already exists. It's called the oil distribution network. And so there's a series of logistical challenges, but there's a possible path to solving that problem. But the environmental question is, well, if it's, you know, you need a lot of energy to split the water or to split the methanol to get the hydrogen out of it. And where are you going to get that energy from? If you're getting that energy from coal, then there's no gain whatsoever. With fuels, most fuel cells operate at, I mean, car internal combustion engines operate at, depending on how you count it, but in terms of the embodied chemical energy in the gasoline to the motion energy of the car, it's about a 95% loss. It's about a 95% loss if what you're trying to do is move a person. With a fuel cell, I mean, they run almost orders of magnitude more efficient. So there's a whole lot of losses that you're not getting in the car itself, energy losses. So it's better from that point of view. But there's still this question at the back of, well, how are you generating the hydrogen? And you could lose everything that you've gained if that was all coming from hydroelectricity, then maybe that would be just about viable, but then you're talking about, well, can you have enough dams in enough places, and what would be the costs and impacts of those dams, etc., etc. There's always lots, you know, there's lots of objections to dam building for exactly the same reason as your question up there, that, you know, people, that they destroy people's aesthetic experiences of certain places, so, as well as risks of earthquakes and the like for big reservoirs at least. So there's no... That's the central dilemma for the fuel cell. But technologically, my sense is that the car firm insiders say that it's just a matter of time before the fuel cell becomes the replacement for the internal combustion engine.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll have to draw that question to a close. Thank you.
This is the question-answer period for a speech called Moving the Earth, Car Culture, by Professor Matthew Patterson of the University of Ottawa and presented by the Vancouver Institute on April 14th, 2007.